The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. I feel like things are changing out there in the world. Now when I talk to strangers that I've never met before, I often get a much more positive feedback on what I'm saying and a much more negative outlook on psychiatric drugs and what it's doing to our population. It's just common now for me to meet folks whose parents or grandparents have been overdrugged and hurried toward death, or people whose children or their grandchildren have been placed on psychiatric drugs and have been harmed and suppressed. There's more and more disclosures, more stuff coming out of Senator Grassley's committee on the misuse of power in the psychiatric community. In Florida, psychiatrists have been under heavy criticism for drugging foster children. I'm working on a lawsuit in Canada to try to stop the drugging of the elderly with antipsychotic agents. And I just met this week with an attorney who's interested in doing something similar to that, may or may not happen here in the U.S. I think it's changing out there. And we need a twofold change. One change is a heightened awareness that drugs are not the answer, that psychiatric diagnoses do not adequately describe people and the struggles that people have. That whole critique of this biological orientation to human suffering. And the other orientation that we need is toward all the positive resources that are available and all the new ones we need to develop to care for people who are in emotional distress. There are projects all over the world now that are pushing the envelope on reducing psychiatric drugs and providing better services. And there are therapists all over the world who are working on developing their skills and developing new skills in helping people in emotional distress. We need the widest possible variety of approaches. My guest today is a dear friend of mine, Wendy West Bidkimini. Wendy's a social worker, licensed clinical social worker, and she's an adjunct professor in the Department of Social Work at Syracuse University, which tells you that Syracuse University is a great place to get a social work degree because Wendy West Bidkimini is there. Her husband's also a wonderful man, and he's in the armed services. He's a chaplain in the armed services. Both of them are on the advisory council of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living. Both of them are just really bringing good stuff into the world. Those of you who have seen my empathic therapy training film, which you can get on Bregin.com, Bregin.com, you can get the empathic therapy training film. You've seen Wendy because spontaneously at the end of the filming of me demonstrating empathic therapy, she did a summary and analysis of what I was doing. And it was enlightening and interesting and indicated her teaching skills. today we're going to talk about wherever we go, but we're going to try to just encourage folks to really believe that there are ways to be helped that are spiritual and psychological rather than biochemical. Hello, Wendy.
Hi, Peter. How are you tonight?
Good. You sound loud and clear. You can't be on your cell phone.
I actually am on my cell phone, but it's working great for me today.
Oh, yeah. That's marvelous. You sound next door.
Excellent.
So, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why don't you start wherever you're comfortable starting, talking about therapy or your work or whatever you think we ought to bring to the folks tonight?
You know, I think what's been on my heart lately to bring to folks, I've spoken to a number of people lately that say that they're searching for therapy, or they've come in to me from previous therapists, some great experience, some not so great. And what I really was hoping we could talk about tonight is what you could expect when you go to therapy, when you're going into good therapy. And I'd like to base that talk off of something that I believe is on your website that talks about the principles of good therapy. And I'd really like to really review some of that and give people an idea, if you are considering counseling, what to expect from a therapist and how to expect to be treated if you're looking to do so from more of a strengths-based perspective or more of a perspective where empathy is really considered key in the therapeutic component. Peter,
are you talking about the guidelines for empathic therapy that I worked out with the help of a bunch of the advisory council members?
Absolutely, and I'd love it if I don't know if you have a copy handy or if you remember from your work, but I'd love it if you would start talking a little bit about that and maybe we could dialogue on that.
Well, I actually don't have it in front of me, but it wouldn't be terribly hard to pull it up. Do you have a copy where you'd like to begin and just talk about it?
Yes, actually.
Go, run with it.
Yeah, the first principle, there's 20 principles, and anyone can go right on to empathictherapy.com and grab copies of the 20 principles of good therapy that Dr. Breggin, as well as myself and a number of colleagues, worked over. And I think the first strategy that Dr. Breggin created is the most important. Good therapy begins with treasuring those who seek help and with building empathic, caring, and inspiring relationships with them. And the reason I love that first one is because of the word treasuring. And I think when people come into therapy, you're already feeling a little exhausted, a little possibly abused, despondent, or maybe hopeless. And the first thing that needs to happen when you come into therapy is to know that you're in a no-judgment zone, you're getting an unbiased, neutral opinion, and that when you walk in there, you will be treasured and thought of as the most important person in the world, that your cares and your concerns are allowed to be dropped off in the office so that you can leave with a much lighter load. And so when you're choosing a therapist or considering going to counseling, the first thing you need to think about when you get on the phone with somebody is, can I really be in relationship with this person? Can I feel trusting? Can I trust this person and be intimate on a conversational level with this person? And do I really believe that they treasure me and my values and who I am? And are they really willing to work on creating a relationship with me? Research has been done over and over again, and the truth of the matter is, you don't need techniques and tools to help people heal. What you need is to be present with them and truly care about them and want them and have a vision for them to get better. So the more the therapist that you choose honors that kind of mentality, the more you can get better in a quick amount of time. Peter?
obviously, with you 100%, one of the things about therapy is that while it's hard work, very, very hard work,
yes,
to think about and look at our issues, our problems, our troubles, depending on what the style is that the therapist is coming from, therapy should actually be a good experience for both the client or the patient and the therapist. And if you really treasure the people you work with as a therapist, And as a client, if you feel like you're really in a good relationship when you go to therapy, that you're really being cared about, and you find yourself even caring about the therapist, then it's a positive, good experience. There isn't going to be a sense of, oh my God, I have to go through therapy, this is awful. And for the therapist, there isn't going to be burnout. There's not going to be this feeling of, oh my God, I got to see another patient. Because the experience is really good when a therapist succeeds and the patient succeeds in building a relationship that's very mutual, that involves understanding, where you're really searching for a mutual understanding of what's going on. It's a very active and exciting and interesting and enjoyable process ultimately.
You know, I like that you also commented that it's hard work. It is hard work, but it can be done with tears and laughter. And I think one of the other pieces to that is sometimes people, when they're in therapy, they think they're going to get better right away. And whether it's long-term or short-term therapy, we're human beings. And it's important to remember when considering therapy or going into therapy that there might be some bumps in the road, meaning there's progression and then you go back a little bit. I think sometimes people view the possibility of going back a little bit as they may have failed, or they're not good enough, or maybe they should just give up and quit because this therapy thing might not be working. And I always tell folks that when you're looking at change, whether it's a diet or coming off of maybe an addictive substance or changing a habit that you've had for a long time, the reality is you might take 2 to 3 steps forward and then 1 step backwards. Part of the change process has relapse in it, and I think sometimes people think that they're going to just soar away and not have some of the bumps in the road, but life is life. Change is hard at times. It can be very stress provoking at times, but it can also be very beautiful and freeing as you go on to the next level. But it's okay to recognize also that there might be some missteps in the road, and the journey might not always have roses and rainbows in it, but that's okay. That's still great work.
I'm again with you 100%, and it's so important for the therapist and the patient together to take responsibility for building a positive, friendly, even warm relationship that does focus nonetheless on responsible hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And these, of course, are basic rules that not only apply to therapy as we go through them, they apply to all of our relationships.
Without
question. So, I don't think I'm much different in therapy. In the film, when I was, doing therapy, Wendy, I imagine I look pretty much like myself up there, don't I?
Absolutely, you do. And I would say I would think I am, too. I'm the same personality in therapy and outside of therapy, without question.
Which means that knowing your personality, it's just going to be a positive experience, basically, even though there may at times be some painful emotions to be dealt with, difficult problems to be faced, because mm-hmm. you bring such a positive yet strong personality to this world of ours. You sure do.
Thank you.
Well, I want you to carry the ball here. I have to keep my eye on communication with the engineer, so I'm happy to have you keep your eye on the empathic therapy guidelines, which are found on empathictherapy.org or .com, but probably empathictherapy.org. So why don't you guide the show for us?
That sounds great, and we'll keep dialoguing along the way. One of the other qualities that I'm noticing that I'd really like to talk about is that good therapy does not try to cure or eliminate symptoms. It shows people how to read these painful emotions and signals in order to identify their source and to transform their lives for the better. And I think sometimes when folks come in to do therapy or they're grabbing self-help opportunities, they think that the cure is the only way to be better. My response to that is it's not about the cure. It really is about learning yourself, learning your thoughts, learning your emotions, learning how come you behave a certain way, and then taking all of that information and using it to transform your life, to move in a different direction, and learning maybe some of the dysfunctional or defeating patterns that folks have learned along the way. And once you recognize them, finding ways and encouraging change and development of more effective choice-making skills. So finding out where things are going wrong, finding those bumps in the road, and getting them under control, putting, if there's a problem in someone's life, if you can't change the environment, it's about changing the perspective and looking forward with hope and finding healing along those lines. Peter, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I'm just in agreement with you, of course. Wendy, go on to another point. I'm just sitting here enjoying hearing you talk.
Well, that's wonderful. Another thing that I'm going to share that I think is very controversial for many people is point number 11, which is good therapy never involves diagnosing or labeling, a process that diminishes personal identity and oversimplifies life. Whereas good therapy encourages people to understand and to embrace the complexity and depth of their own life stories.
I really like the concept of story, of at times even scripts. Today I was talking with a patient that I care a lot about who's been through a very oppressive life. Well, you know, like in so many cases, the family has a script. The family has a script for one member as the failure and the other member as a success. Families have scripts for the limitations that there are on people. And you want to write your own script. You want to write your own story. When a psychiatrist tells you you're bipolar, that psychiatrist, in one phrase, has written your story for you. You're bipolar, you're stuck, you need drugs, you need to think of yourself with this diagnosis. Who are you? You're not Peter Breggin, you're bipolar. You're not Jane Smith, you're bipolar. So you want to really think about your life as your own story. You want to understand your story. And then you want to write it better and better and make it come out better and better. And to view your life as a diagnosis, or as Wendy was saying earlier, as symptoms, will tremendously impede your growth. You can't just get rid of anxiety. You can get a lobotomy and not care. You can get drugs and get confused about it. But then it's going to get worse over time, and you won't have dealt with why you're anxious. You can get sad and depressed and blunted for a while with drugs. But the real issue is, what is my life about? What are my feelings about? Why am I feeling sad now? Why am I feeling out of control? Why am I feeling anxious? Who am I? What am I about? What is all this about? We have all these emotions in response to our lives, to our lives. So I would say anybody who wants to diagnose you has an interest at stake that's not really yours. And the interest is control, the interest is drugs, but it's not in your interest, generally speaking, to be diagnosed. Wendy?
I think that the reality, too, is a long time ago the medical model was created, and the medical model is a notion that was created for physicians to diagnose. And it basically means you come in, you tell your doctor, I'm sniffling, I'm sneezing, I feel nauseous, I have a high fever, and I'm achy all over. That is an immediate cue to a physician to say you might have the flu. And that's the medical model. You come in, you share your symptoms, they give a name to it, and they specifically treat it with whatever works best for that particular ailment. The problem with the medical model is it's been transformed into being used into the psychiatric world, which I think at times it's what we have to do for insurance's purposes, et cetera. However, what it does is it labels folks and diagnoses folks, and the reality is the human mind is so complex that not every symptom will match the label. So there's a lot of misdiagnosing in the community. I have a very good friend that an experiment and went around with the same symptoms to different doctors, psychological doctors, and came out with numerous different diagnoses. It's a very subjective form of working, and it does not fit like a glove the psychiatric world. It's definitely perfect for the medical model in the medical physical community, but in the emotional mental community, it just falls short. And it is the system we've embraced and what we've come to know. But realize when you're going in too that if someone is looking to not only diagnose you, that you are not just that label. So even if you're listening to this and you are already diagnosed with anxiety, depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, etc., the reality is that you are, I liken it to a very big pie chart, and there's little slices throughout, and you have many different roles that you take in life: mother, father, sister, brother, colleague, friend, etc., volunteer. And that is one slice of your life. A diagnosis or label, if you already have one, is not who you are. It is not your being. It is just one slice of information that someone uses to describe possibly some symptoms you might be going through. But those symptoms are workable, and it's about getting with the right person you can trust and be real with and process things with and find new ways to cope and to heal and to move forward in a hopeful, joyous way. Peter?
Yeah. I mean, this is very real, folks. It is not pie in the sky. You use the pie metaphor. It's not pie in the sky. This is real stuff. You can really decide that you don't want to be a diagnosed person and a drugged person. You can really decide that you want to think of yourself as a loving human being who takes responsibility for her life or his life, who has friends and children and work or other activities, volunteering, where you're giving to the universe, and to see yourself as a source of love and creativity and responsibility. That's what we are, and that's how we are all basically the same. I mean, that's what we all face. How are we going to bring forth this real human best core of ourselves, which is the loving, responsible, creative, active human being? And don't let someone tell you you're a diagnosis and that core should be hidden beneath a cloud of drugs. I was also thinking, Wendy, about your mentioning that doctors, the psychiatrists treat us like we're diseases, really, and you use the image of the flu, the person who's, achy all over and has a fever and feels sick and isn't doing very well, and you give a medication or whatever. Well, biological psychiatry is such a fantasy that the practitioners actually forget the basic medicine they've learned in order to promote the fantasy. So if you go into your psychiatrist, and let's say you've been on 20 milligrams of Prozac for a while, and you tell your psychiatrist you're achy all over and you got a fever and chills and all, the first thing that goes through his mind should be, maybe you have a serotonin syndrome, because that sounds a lot like that. Let's make sure it's not just the flu. Yet the psychiatrist, in my experience, is more likely than not to even think of serotonin syndrome. Well, let's say you've skipped a dose of your medication, your Prozac or your Celex, or one of the shorter-acting ones, say Celex, and you come in, and you tell the psychiatrist to give him this flu-like syndrome again. What are the odds that psychiatrist is going to say, well, of course you're in drug withdrawal? No, probably not. Because, in fact, in order to keep the fantasy going, biologically oriented psychiatry, which is pretty much all of modern psychiatry, isn't really rooted in real medicine. They're not going to think about the severe disorders caused by the drugs. They're not going to think about the severe withdrawal reactions, which, by the way, you must take into account if you're listening to the show and you're going to think about reducing your medication. Hopefully you can find some decent clinical supervision, maybe from a combination of your therapist and your primary care, because your psychiatrist is probably going to tell you to take more. But maybe with a combination of a good therapist, your primary care doctor, you can come off. But you got to come off slowly if you've been on these drugs for a while. But biological psychiatry is really so baseless that the docs who practice it forget the basic tenets of adverse drug reactions, drug withdrawal, and also other causes that could be medical. You know, you could be going through menopause. You could have a hormonal disorder. You could be have a brain tumor. You could have any number of things that could be diabetes that could be causing you to feel depressed or fatigued. But again, your psychiatrist is most likely to just give you a drug. Wendy, you want to go on with the points of empathic therapy guidelines from empathictherapy.org?
Absolutely. I think one of a nice segue to what we've been talking about is that good therapy recognizes that personal suffering, helpless feelings, anxiety, sadness, and other demoralizing human experiences, that they can be understood as responses to the stress and difficulty of life. Instead of viewing these reactions as pathology suitable for diagnosis, good therapy definitely sees them as signals that the individual needs to take steps to improve his or her quality of life. What I like to tell folks is when they're starting to feel physiological or any form of stress in their bodies, they're shaky or they're anxious in some way or they're feeling extremely sad and depressed, that those feelings coming about, they're a temperature gauge for you to stop and sit for a minute and assess your life and decide, am I moving in a direction that's making me happy, or am I working against my own value system? Many times people will find that the sadness and the anxiety and things that are going on in their lives, grief or the sense of powerlessness or worthlessness, comes from patterns or interactions that they've learned from childhood through adulthood. And it's about finding ways to locate those patterns and change those patterns, as well as how you deal with some of the sadness that may have occurred in your life. Peter?
Very much, very, very much again with you on that. Emotions are signals.
Yes.
There's no truth to them. I mean, you can feel passionately in love and in fact be repeating some miserable pattern where you pour your feelings out to somebody who is never going to love you back, just like your mother didn't love you back, you know, that you're just repeating that pattern. So all feelings, even what feels like love, has to be also thought about. It's a signal. It's a signal. You can be anxious because you're repeating the same old thing of going out with an abusive guy or an abusive woman, or you're getting married again for the wrong reasons. Or you can be anxious because you're thinking about being more brave and more daring, and you're scared about the next steps, and you have to take them into really look at how to proceed and how to grow. You can be depressed. I'll give you a simple example of people often come to therapy after they've lost a parent. Let's say you've lost your father. Might have even been a couple of years later. Usually they get drugs the first day, and it's nowadays they come later after they realize that didn't work. And they come and they've lost their father, and they're feeling very depressed about it. And it turns out that this is not just mourning. This isn't just, oh, loss of a loved one. In fact, that rarely goes on forever. That just becomes a part of your heart with time, and you carry the person with you, and you continue to get inspiration from the person you loved and lost. At least that's the strongest way and best spiritual way to go about it. But often it's that the loss, the pain, the suffering you're feeling is because that person never gave you what you needed, and you never got it, and you never got to get mad at them, and you never got to try to wring it out of them, and you're actually in a state of chronic anger and frustration. So just even feeling depressed or feeling anxious, doesn't tell you much. Once you've found it, you got to find out, what is this about? Who am I? Where did this stuff come from? Am I really missing Dad? No. I never got anything from Dad. Or, yes, I am missing Dad. You know, he loved me, he cared about me, I could always go back and rely on him. And then you can go through a mourning process of feeling it, feeling how much you love Dad, and maybe even coming to the conclusion Dad's still there in some way. So, again, feelings are signals, and we've got to put our hearts into figuring them out. Wendy, we're going to take a break in a minute. And I want to think about this difficult task I give myself my guests. And that is, I want to think about how to communicate even more directly. What's the experience of coming to Wendy like? To Wendy West Petimini. What's it like? And what's, maybe I'll be brave and try to communicate. What's it like coming to see Peter Bregan? And as we go to break, Wendy, for 5 seconds, you want to just give how people can get in touch with you, and then we'll go to music.
People can contact me by going to my website at nurturinglifeconcepts.com. Again, it's nurturinglifeconcepts.com.
Thank you, Wendy. Let's go to break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and my guest, Wendy West Petimini, social worker, licensed clinical social worker, and adjunct professor at Syracuse University. We're talking, kind of using as a template for our discussion, the guidelines for empathic therapy that I worked out with the help of Wendy and 10 or 12 people on our advisory council of Empathic Therapy Center. That's empathictherapy.org. And reminding you, it is not too early to sign up for the conference we may fill this year. We came within 10 or 12 people of filling last year, so there's a real chance of that. And it's April 13, 14, and 15. In Syracuse, and you get everything you need to know about it and signing up for it at empathictherapy.org. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I miss you. We haven't gotten together personally in quite a long time. Hazards of being busy, having busy lives.
I know. It's so true, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I would love to help people get an idea about what to expect when they come for therapy. You've been talking about, but could you describe, or is that too much to ask? Do you want me to describe, or do you want to role play? Give folks a sense of what is it like to go to the therapist that really is interested in you.
I think that when you know that you're walking into a therapist's office that really cares about you, you should expect to have this sense in your heart and in your mind that says, this person really gets me. It's really about the person that you're talking to, the clinician, being unbiased and really listening to you. And what I mean by really listening, turning up their own dialogue within their head or their own agenda. I've heard folks tell me, and I'm not making fun of anyone out there who is a clinician, we have a very difficult job. But there are times when I have been told that the person working with some of my clients has come, if the office is in the house, that they've come in their pajamas. I've heard clients tell me that the person was forgetting their name. I've heard others say that the clinician kept looking at the clock. And one person even told me that someone fell asleep on them. And those are the type of things that you definitely would not expect when you're going into a good clinician's office. You should expect to be nurtured, to be valued, to be thought of as a person with strengths and skills and values and a personal story that deserves to be told and deserves to be heard. So it's really about coming to a warm, inviting place and having a chat with a mentor or a very close friend that has wisdom and insight that can assist you in learning the deeper processes of who you are and helping you find ways to reclaim your life and walk through it in a victorious, not victimized way. Peter?
Yes. I love all your imagery. I remember when I was in my training and one of my professors said that there's no way around it, that it takes wisdom to do therapy. And I remember being really resentful as a young psychiatrist in training and thinking, no, I have good techniques. I guess I knew I didn't have enough wisdom yet. But, you know, I had so much caring that even though I lacked some wisdom, it really mattered to people. Early in my experience as a therapist, I wanted to know what the people who were doing well. I had a number of people who were doing really well and couples who were doing well and some who hadn't, who had finished. And I called them back and asked them to come in, or I asked the people I was seeing to take a special hour, of course, no charge, and to talk to me about what was helping them. And I remember I was expecting them to talk about my approach, to talk about having all their feelings about the past and looking at their past histories and stuff, all of which, you know, to one degree or another, they thought was useful. But what I heard uniformly from everyone was, Peter, you cared so much about me, I started caring about myself. And that is so core, because people give up on themselves, they give up on caring about themselves, they give up on thinking that they matter, that they even deserve a good life. And you inspire, you guide with wisdom. I do think there's no way around it. We're like moral philosophers in a way. Freud, among all the stupid things he said a few good ones, and one of them was that analysts, really therapists is what I'd say now, are moral guides. They're not medical doctors, they're moral guides. And Freud himself didn't think that you should be a medical doctor. Freud wasn't a psychiatrist, by the way. People think psychiatry began with Freud. Actually, Freud never was accepted in psychiatry, never taught in a medical school. But for a while, some psychiatrists also trained as psychotherapists and psychoanalysts, but that's not anymore. And we're guides, and expect some good, useful guidance. I really want, if you come to see me, I really want you to walk out thinking, hey, I learned something about myself. I'm gonna handle myself better at work tomorrow. I'm gonna give a better greeting and relate better to my wife and kids tonight. Or I'm gonna stand up for myself better right away. Or I'm gonna set some limits on someone right away. Or I might even get on the phone tonight and talk to mom about what happened 20 years ago, and maybe we can work it out better, or I can come to a better understanding. So it's an active process where a person should feel like they're learning something from this process. And that does require a certain amount of wisdom and understanding, but I think caring is so core to it.
I think another piece too is it's important to remember for folks seeking counseling that the counselors are human too. We do make mistakes, and that's okay, because it's a safe environment and it can be dialogued out. And so it's important to remember that we're both humans in the room, and we both deserve compassion and respect and care, because it is a two-way street. Another area I think I'd like to talk about with regard to counseling, sometimes folks come in and they think that this is where you get to ventilate and air out all of your pain, which it is, don't get me wrong. But there's also a point of venting and then moving to a place of healing. And so when you're talking about a problem, I really believe firmly that you need to talk about the problem and heal the problem, but the problem is never the person, the problem is the problem. So what I mean by that is keep yourself, when you're dealing with your issues, not in a complaining way, but focused on the problem, not the people in your life thinking that they're bad or they're horrible. The problem is the problem. Focus on that and find ways to heal from the problem. And create, like Peter said, learn some skills to maybe speak a little bit better, put limits on people, be more assertive as opposed to being passive or aggressive. But in addition, you don't want to spend your whole time with someone that's counseling you on just what's going wrong. And you want to talk about things like, how can we get better? How can we heal this? What are some solutions? What are some skills I might need to put in place? Do I need to change my thinking? Do I need to problem solve? Do I need to get some additional techniques or skills into my life so that I can manage things a different way? Should I be changing or transforming or modifying how I live? Because that might be causing me some significant discomfort and things of that nature. Peter?
Yeah, I think the issue of venting is really important. There's a few different things about it that I want to talk about, and they all apply to life. Once in a while, a person will come into therapy in the first 10 minutes or 20 minutes. They'll be very angry at me, maybe because of my fees, maybe because of something they've read I've said, or maybe they've misunderstood me in the first few minutes or whatever. And I will very, very quickly, you know, try to clear it up. I'll say, you know, is there anything I've done? Let's talk about that. That's making you angry. I'm really willing to look at that. But if it persists and this person is just expressing rage at me for their past, I'll tell them this isn't going to work. That you must not make another human being feel uncomfortable and then expect you're going to get the best help. So if you want the best help from me, just as I'm going to be kind and gentle toward you, you need to also be thinking about that in regard to me, because you won't get where you want to go by making somebody else uncomfortable. And that person might then say, what, isn't this the place where I get to say whatever I want? Isn't this where I get to be as angry as I want? Isn't it where I learned to do that? And I'll say, well, you know, frankly, I think you've probably been doing that for years. No, this isn't where you get to finally say everything you want. I really do suspect you've been doing that before. This is where you get to learn to communicate in a caring, valuable, useful way, where you actually learn to get what you want from other human beings. So it's not about that, venting. Now, if you're a person who's not in touch with your anger, it's very important to get in touch with your anger, but never in a helpless fashion. The person who's raging at you as a therapist, or raging at their family, or just out of control in that manner, is actually being helpless. It's a kind of a pseudo-strength. I'm strong because I can be enraged. It's a real pseudo-strength. And you want to help people, and you want to be thinking about this for yourself, to not vent and be angry in a helpless, victimized, overwhelmed way. If you're going to feel your anger, feel it in a way that the adult is feeling it, not the helpless child. Make sense?
Absolutely. You know, as you're talking, Peter, about relationships and communication, I was thinking about the 3-point discussion I share with folks, that there's 3 points that are happening even actually at an unconscious level when people go to communicate with other people. And those 3 different levels are, the first one is, what's the goal in my mind here as I'm about to speak to this individual? The second piece would be, what's the value I place on this relationship and with regard to this person? And the third issue that people think about before they communicate with someone is, how will I leave this with my self-respect intact, or how can I leave this with a good feeling? And I think that that's important to remember, that this is all happening in your brain unconsciously as you're dealing with different people. So, for an example, if you're at the grocery store and you're in line purchasing something, what's the goal of this relationship between you and the cashier? It's to get my groceries checked out and as quick and efficient as the time as possible. what's the value that you have on the relationship? Probably very minimal. It's just, you know, meaningless chatter at best. And the third part would be, did you leave with a warm smile? Did you feel like you were able to be kind and communicative with that particular cashier? That would give you a good sense of who you are. Now, take that in a different note. Are you fighting with your partner? What's the goal of the relationship? You wanted to get a specific answer out of your partner, and it might not be working. What value do you place on that relationship? It's a high value if it's someone that you love and you're happy to be partnered with. But at the moment, you're giving into your coping mechanisms of possibly anger or stress or name-calling or something along those lines. So you're devaluing the relationship by doing that. And the third piece, are you pleased with your own actions? Are you comfortable with what you did, or are you leaving upset with how you managed the situation? Those kinds of things have to be taken into consideration as you're moving forward with relationships and communicating. What goal do I have? How important is this relationship? And how much do I respect and value myself after I leave this relationship? Was I true to who I am? Those things are important, because if you're not following a positive approach in those three venues, then you're ending up walking away feeling poorly about yourself, poorly about the situation, or maybe poorly about the person, which brings about negative effects in your life. So those are things to take into consideration when you're communicating.
One of the ways I put it, and it's really poignant in couples therapy, is I suggest to the people involved that every word that comes out of their mouth, that every communication should be given with the goal of advancing the relationship, moving the relationship to an ever better place. And it's kind of cute to watch people struggle with that, because in the beginning they're going to open their mouths and then they're going to look at me and say, well, this isn't, and I'll say, well, then don't. Think again. Find a way to address this in a way that advances the relationship. And people actually do begin to learn. They begin to say things in ways where they own their own responsibility, to say things in ways that are communicating affection and respect, to raise issues that actually can be solved rather than beat the partner with. So if you're thinking that, those of you listening to us, that from the checkout person to how you treat your therapist and your therapist treats you and how you treat your family, if you're thinking, is this communication going to advance the relationship, you're going to be just improving your life with everything that comes out of your mouth. It's a miracle to actually find a way to do that. And it makes great therapy work, because there are the barriers to it. No, I'm ashamed to be that vulnerable. No, I'm too angry to let them get away with my just being kind. No, I got to bring up the past. I'm still hurting from the past. And I got to bring it up in an angry way. And it really, really confronts people with the negative emotions that are blocking a positive way of relating. And one other thought about that. People get afraid that if they behave in ways that Wendy and I are suggesting, that they'll be weak and vulnerable. But it's so untrue. You know, we are most weak and vulnerable when we're most armored and angry. The more armored and rigid and angry and defensive we are, the more we will get hurt, the more we will feel the hurt, and the less likely we are to leave people who are hurting us, or at least to ask them to change, because we're armored for battle, and people armored for battle stay in battle maybe their whole lives. Whereas if you approach relationships with the anticipation that you're going to be advancing the relationship, saying things that are fun and good, or under conflict, things that are going to help resolve the conflict, then it's going to be very clear to you when you're being attacked, because you'll know it isn't you. You know it's not you being armored and angry. You'll know it's coming from the other person. You'll be much more able to perceive danger and risk and to make up your mind about it. The more loving you are in general, the more open your heart, the more you will see the risks and dangers as they come at you. Wendy, your thoughts?
Well, you know, as you were talking, I was hoping that you would share with folks what your definition of love is and why you find it to be so important.
Well, my definition of love is joyful awareness. Whether you're just happy to have your dog at your side, my Shetland sheepdogs who sometimes come into the sessions, whether your heart is warmed by a sunset or a leaf or a pretty rock, or whether you feel the joy of kinship and the joy of the smile on your loved one's face, the joy of seeing your children grow, the joy of a really wonderful romantic and sexual relationship. All of love, I think, is ultimately about joy. And so if you're miserable and unhappy, that may be about being human, and that may be about your relationship, but it's not really about love. Love is actually happy. Love enables us to be happy in the midst of conflict with a loved one because we don't lose track of treasuring that other human being. So love is joy, joyful awareness of someone or something, including God. Love is joyful awareness, and it brings out in us treasuring and nurturing and caring and all these other feelings. Now, when we lose love, it causes suffering, but that's not what love is about. In fact, the more we remember the loved one and carry the loved one, the more we'll go through the mourning and come out again happier and richer as a person. We can get punished and made miserable in a relationship, but that's not love. That's not love from the other person. It's not due to our love. You can be miserable when you hate another human being in a relationship. Love is about a joyful, happy, heartwarming experience. And if you can keep that in mind, you're going to have a guidepost. You're going to have a shining light to lead you in your life.
I think as people go forward in these last few minutes of your program today, I think it's important for folks in all your relationships, take stock of all of those relationships in your life, from the most menial day-to-day picking up things at the store to the most important, most intimate people that you're extremely close to. And think about the ways that you can move forward selflessly in those relationships, really advancing those relationships, as Peter had mentioned, Dr. Breggin had mentioned, as well as walking in life with this joyful awareness. And in order to do that, I would say that it's imperative that as you're listening to this program today, take stock in who you are and what you absolutely love about yourself. The more you love you and value you as a person with strengths as well as weaknesses, and love yourself in totality just the way you are with those strengths and with those weaknesses, and with those bumps and bruises, as well as those awards and celebrations, and embrace yourself in totality, the more you can give to the world. In addition, I would ask that you switch your perspective and really focus on what's going well in these moments. What strengths are you seeing, and what is wonderful? The hot sun on your skin, the beauty of the birds and the tree, the beautiful snow that we don't have very much of this particular winter. Take a
yes.
look and look for the
Wendy, yes. We're finishing up. It's a pleasure. You know, I wish I were with you. We got to be with each other more face-to-face, but it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Folks, if you want to advance the work that Wendy and I and others are trying to do, join empathictherapy.org. Come to our conference March 13th through 15th. No one makes money on this conference. No one personally makes any money on the work we do. In fact, we support the work. I give pennies. I don't take pennies out of the nonprofit. We do it because we want to advance even more than just our own personal relationships. We want to advance the profession and the world. And come join us. Be a part of empathictherapy.org. And if you want to see me and Wendy around therapy issues, me doing therapy, Wendy commenting on it. You know, you can get the empathic therapy training film off of Bregan.com. But and that I do get some money from. But join the Empathic Therapy Center. It's inexpensive. You get a fabulous free newsletter. Whether you join or not, you can get the newsletter. That's the secret. And you know, get involved with us. We need to really let the world know that biological psychiatry is not the answer, that empathic caring, wisdom, love, education, self-empowerment, the answers lie in the human arena. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.